p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
And good afternoon. It is 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today in the first hour from a September 21st, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Walking with Beth, you'll hear Marilyn Simons reading from and talking about her book, also called Walking with Beth. In the second hour, from a January 27th Novel Idea Bookstore double book launch, you'll hear Theodore Christou with his book, Torch Song for Grace, and actually me with my new book called Ever Crossings, launching our books of poetry that night. Jason Haru emceed the event. And I've got a very tight first hour, so it just kind of fits perfectly in there, so I don't want to talk too much here, but I'm going to just go ahead then and move straight in it. From a September 21st, again, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Walking with Beth, you'll hear Marilyn Simons reading from her book of the same name, and I'm going to read, I think I have time, yes. Just a short synopsis that comes with their Kingston Writers Fest program guide for the festival every year. And it says, in the spring of 2021, Marilyn Simons asked her friend Beth Robinson if she'd like to go for a walk. Beth had just turned 70, entering what struck her as a mysterious, even frightening stage of life. Beth, a vibrant centurion, was as awake to the world as a person half her age. Who better to ask at what might come next? Walking with Beth is a unique take on longevity and friendship, full of wisdom, tenderness, joy, and the passions that sustain a long life. Here we go with that event. I was there. It was great. Hope you enjoy it.
About the first thing, et cetera.
See this room filled, and for a very good reason. Thank you. I'm Jan Walter. I'm a member of the festival committee, and I'm honored to introduce Walking with Beth, the very last event of this festival. First, let us acknowledge the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples who lived here before us and who still call this territory home. We're grateful for the opportunity to share this space that is so rich in history, language, and storytelling. Once again, I draw your attention to a Pan-Canada chair. As we gather to celebrate our freedom to write and read, this empty chair symbolizes the absence of a writer whose defense of these freedoms has led to their persecution and imprisonment. Please go to the Pan-Canada website to find out more about their good work. Kingston Writers Fest would like to thank the joint sponsors of this event, Senior Transitions and Profile Kingston Magazine, and Marilyn's author patron, Christine Everdale of Tummy Tots Occupational Therapy. Of course, we're also grateful to the City of Kingston Arts Fund, the Ontario Arts Council, and the Canada Council for the Arts, especially the Governor General's Award Book Fund, as well as the many institutions, businesses, and individuals who support the festival. And of course, the dedicated and highly skilled volunteers who have worked incredibly hard these past 4 days and months to bring this festival to you. To every one of them, our now is the moment to turn off or mute any devices that might distract us in the brief time we have left together. Please refrain from taking pictures or recording the event. We have a festival photographer and videographers, I see, whose work will be posted on our website. Now it's my pleasure to introduce an author many of you know very well, Marilyn Simons. Marilyn's many books defy easy categorization. The Convict Lover was labeled a nonfiction novel. The Lion in the Room Next Door was described variously as a book of short stories, memoir, and autofiction. She's recognized as a pioneer in the realm of creative nonfiction. And by her own description, she has written short fiction, three novels, various memoirs, and two biographies, always driven by an insatiable curiosity. A reviewer of her 2022 book, Woman Watching, a biography of the ornithologist Louise de Kerlin Lawrence, described it as, quote, an entrancing blend of biography, memoir, history, research, and homage that is unlike anything I've ever read. It's radical, it's ravishing. Another described Marilyn as a thoughtful writer who handles complexities with aplomb, with both insight and delicacy. In Walking with Beth, Conversations with My 100-Year-Old Friend, Marilyn again illuminates the rich and unseen life of a fascinating and complex woman. In a world where women are increasingly invisible as they age, Walking with Beth is both a monument to her dear friend and a vital invitation to keep our eyes open to change. An early review of this book, which is not yet officially published, by the way, called it a breathtaking gift. Indeed it is. Please welcome the acting artistic director of Kingston Writers Fest, Marilyn Simon.
Jan is an icon of Canadian publishing. She was my first literary book editor, and as we heard last night, she edited The New Romans, a landmark anthology on the Canadian relationship to the United States, of which Elbows Up is the sequel. Jan won't tell you any of this because she is the soul of modesty and diplomacy. Jan and I founded Kingston Writers Fest together back in 2009, picking up the name when a small festival that was developed by the library and Kingston Literacy and Indigo Books collapsed up in its third year. This winter, when Kingston Writers Fest once again came to the brink of extinction, Jan and I got together and raised the money to pay off the considerable debt, and then formed a board, and then gathered an amazing festival committee to plan and produce the festival. Okay. Our first instinct was just to make sure that the writers were paid, and all the venues and everything. So that the festival could die with dignity, if that was the will of the people. We kept setting deadlines when we would step aside, but it soon became clear we needed to shepherd the festival through this transition year. You've seen Jan everywhere over the past 4 days, attending to all kinds of things. We've both been working way out of our comfort zone. But mostly, I mean, her skill and commitment is stellar, but her brilliance in programming, which you have all benefited from over the past few days, it cannot go unremarked. And so please, a huge round of applause for the woman without you, Mr. Miles. And have a runny nose. This is the first time I've presented this book because, as Jan said, it's not out yet, right? This is the second book, you know, last night with Elbows Up, that book isn't out yet either. So, you know, it's kind of amazing. But I'm going to be crying, I just know it. So thank you for whoever was thoughtful enough to put Kleenex beside me. One of the stories that Beth told me is that she grew up in a family that was perpetually grateful. And being here with all of you at the end of this extraordinary 4 days, which comes at the end of an extraordinary 6 months, during which, with your help and the help of countless others, we have revived the festival. I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude. I'm grateful to be part of this community, to come together to share stories. You see, I'm going to cry. I know it. But you know, it's worth crying. The act of writing and reading are solitary, but the sharing of stories requires a community, and that's what we're building here. So just thank all of you. I'm just so grateful for all of you. I hardly know how to begin this afternoon because I know many of you in the audience know Beth way longer than I have known her. For those of you who don't know the Beth of the title of the book, she is Elizabeth Pierce Robinson, daughter of Warren Pierce, who in many ways was the groundskeeper to the flowering of Canadian literature. Her mother was a groundbreaking collector of early Canadian glass and a historian of glassmaking. Her aunt, Alice Chown, was a fierce and early suffragette who greatly influenced her mother, took her to the big march in England in service of the vote, and in turn influenced Beth herself. And Beth is here with us this afternoon in the front row. Beth is 105 as of July. Other for about 40 years, give or take. Neither of us remembers when we met. Everybody asked me, and I said, I had no idea. And we tried. We really tried to figure it out, but we just couldn't. I feel as though you have always been in my life, Beth said to me, and I feel the same way. And that's how it is with friends. And more than anything, walking with Beth is a book about friendship. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Beth, a little bit about myself, our walks together, and mostly I'll read bits from the book. The book is organized in almost 90-something little short passages. It doesn't have a big normal arc. It is rather more like a conversation with a friend that come, you know, subjects come in and out as you read the book. And I hope by the end makes you feel intimate with the subjects of the book. So I'm going to start not at the beginning, but close to it. In fact, probably close to my beginning, with a piece called Old Ladies. The three women lean into each other in the photograph, laughing. They are old, and they're dressed funny, like toddlers, wearing whatever strikes their fancy. Mismatched patterns, silly hats, baggy pants, florid tops. They are standing on the deck of the SS Rio Tunisian as it steams south through the Atlantic from New York City to Rio de Janeiro in the fall of 1956. I was 7 when I met the three lovely, lively crones, but they weren't my first old ladies. I boarded that ship still in love with Miss Getz, my grade one teacher in the four-room red brick schoolhouse I walked to every weekday morning. Miss Getz must have been about 60. She retired when I was in grade 6, old enough to tap dance at her retirement party, and no, I'm not going to tap dance this afternoon. I remember Miss Getz from the ground up. Thick-heeled, lace-up black shoes, tweed pencil skirt that stopped mid-calf, a frilly blouse, its hint of flair held in check under a cardigan, cashmere, I like to think, although it was probably hand-knit from some stiff wool. I can't conjure her face or her hair, but I will never forget her voice, stern and cool in the classroom as she insisted a girl in grade 2 clean up her own vomit. yet strangely softened in the living room of her house by the river on a back street of our village in southwestern Ontario. I don't know why I went there that first time. Maybe I was delivering something from my mother, who was always sending baking here and there in the village. Maybe Miss Getz heard I was moving to Brazil and invited me over. Her house was nothing like the houses of my friends. Her rooms were filled with mementos from her travels, colorful embroidered cushions, painted candy dishes, candle holders fitted with candles that were lit at any time of day, not just on special occasions. Everything had been chosen and placed by her hand, no other, which gave the rooms, I think now, a singular scent, an unmuddied tone. At the time, I didn't know anyone who had been further than Toronto, where my grandparents lived, an hour's drive away. But Miss Getz had traveled to Greece, France, Egypt, names that felt delicious in my mouth. I'd sit drinking tea, heavily laced with milk and sugar, while she told me about these foreign places, speaking to me like a friend. I wonder now why I found these older women so appealing. Someone to do for, to make me feel needed? I don't think so. These women, Ellen Stafford, who chose her own name in midlife, taking it from the British Shire where she lived, and who published her first novel the year she turned 80, Louise in her log cabin on Pimisi Bay, sipping strong coffee, smoking unfiltered cigarettes, getting up before dawn to make her daily bird count well into her 90s. Erna, who gave birth to her first son in a German barn as she fled the invading Russians. These women didn't need anything from me. What did I need from them? They listened, Beth says, when I tell her about my lifelong attraction to older women. Intently. I guess they did, I say, but what I remember most is the way they talked to me. Not like other adults, telling me what to do, how to do it. Just conversation, like what we're doing now. Now I am the old lady. I dress funny. As I write this, a long burgundy skirt with sequins, an inset lace, a misshapen gray cashmere sweater, sensible zip-up shoes, striped compression stockings, and a vest made from bright scraps of brocade and signed on the inside by the artist, which I bought at the Bodega de Sorpresa in Mexico for a peso song. Many of the clothes in my closet come from the surprise shop, where gringos deposit their barely worn outfits to make room in their suitcases for souvenirs. Still, I am not so old that I can't find a woman older than I am. Beth is my old lady now, my last guide into the future. Like a symphony. You don't have to clap after every section. If you do, your hands are going to get really sore. So I say guide, but that doesn't mean Walking with Beth is a how-to book. Do this and do that and you'll live to 105, like Beth. At first, there was no purpose to our meanderings, not to our walks or to our talks. We followed the conversation wherever it took us. We read to each other, we passed books back and forth, made notes. We delighted in each other, and we learned from each other the way friends do. It was a hard time. It was 2021, the end of the first year of COVID when we thought the pandemic would be over, and it wasn't. The rules seemed to change every week. Restaurants closed and opened, then closed again. Kids stopped going to school, everything shut down. Those of us who were compromised had more to fear. We isolated ourselves even more from the world. For many, not just us, walking became a respite from the isolation. For Beth and I, not only did our walks get us out of the house, our talks took us out of ourselves and into the wide, wide world. So I'm going to read a little section now called Possibilities. Here we go. Beth greets me at the door in red running shoes, jeans, a cashmere sweater the color of cherries, and a soft shawl that is flaming sunset. Her steel-gray hair is pulled back with a dark headband. I'm often struck by her beauty, but today I have to take a moment to catch my breath. She has been thinking of subtitles for this accumulation of words that may one day coalesce into a book. From retirement to Mount Pleasant, she says, with a glint in her eye. Mount Pleasant, as some of you obviously know, is the Toronto cemetery where my father's family is buried and where a plot awaits Beth's remains. What about me, I say? I don't want to be buried. I've told Wayne to just shove me up the chimney. We both laugh. This book is for women, Beth says, turning serious. I nod in agreement. The female path through the latter stages of life is not the same as that of a man. For one thing, we live longer. In Canada, at the moment, the average life expectancy for a little girl born in 2020 is 84 years. 80 for a boy. As a 71-year-old, I have survived what my mother called the first great culling, which happens to people in their late 50s. One year, 9 of our friends died. Beth has survived the second culling at 75, which took my mother and Wayne's father. The life expectancy charts don't go past 90, at which point a woman can expect to live another 5.5 years. At 101, it's anyone's guess how long Beth will carry on. Or 105. But she has a theory about why she has lived not only this long, but in such relatively good health. I suffered terribly from migraines in my 40s, she says. An American doctor who had a cottage near ours suggested an elimination diet. For a month, I ate mostly rice and greens. Then slowly, I introduced my usual foods. I'd take my pulse before eating a new food, swallow a teaspoon of it, then 10 minutes later, take my pulse again. Sugar, whole wheat, and rye flour, coffee, and meat didn't make it. I cut them out, and almost immediately, I felt better. Since then, Beth has been mostly vegetarian, nourishing herself on vegetables, nuts, and beans with fruit in limited amounts. I've always been able to say no, she says. I could use a lesson in that. She pauses for a moment, adjusting her therapist's hat. I'm a great believer in intuition, she says finally. I spent much of my therapy time encouraging people to trust their intuition. If someone says, let's go for a walk, you listen first to your internal response. No, that's not right for me at this moment. Or, yes, let's. I would encourage them to listen to that intuitive response. The unconscious is a storehouse of our life experiences, and out of that pool of experiences will come suggestions that are useful and appropriate. I think of my childhood home, my silent, rigid father, my mother walking on eggshells, all four daughters, like so many women, learning to do the same. But what if all your life experiences have trained you to do what pleases others, I say. You still have to listen to your intuition, Bess says. Learn to take a breath. Stop. Listen. Then answer. Finally, Beth and I allow ourselves a visit indoors. This is a really big deal. Beth was still driving then. In fact, she only stopped driving last year, not because she was told to, but because she felt that that part of her life, and she did love driving, especially sports cars, had come to its natural end. I stopped driving before she did, felled by a difficult illness. I find myself using the word still a lot with Beth. Still driving, still living on her own, still writing, still making art. As if there is an expiration date to any of these things, for any of us. This is The Empress of Radical Happiness. Beth is coming to visit. I can count on one hand the friends who have stepped over our threshold in this first year of pandemic isolation. But Beth is vaccinated and so am I. Neither of us is symptomatic, but we test anyway. Negative. Our excuse for defying the public health stay-at-home order hangs on the wall. In the depths of our first winter in Canada in more than a decade, my husband and I bought an enormous painting of San Miguel's distant desert hills by Catherine Bruce, a Canadian artist who works in Mexico half the year. I spotted the painting the first time we visited Catherine's house. The image was inspired by the view from her rooftop terrace and by the cactus garden outside her studio. For me, the painting is Mexico. The color, Beth exclaims the minute she enters the room. The energy of those lines. She reaches to touch the filaments of electric blue, white, gold, and hot pink that flash across the canvas like carnival streamers. And look at this, I say gently, laying my hands on her shoulders and swiveling her to face the opposite wall. She gasps. Meet the Empress of Radical Happiness, I say. The oversized huipil created by our San Miguel friend, Lena Bartula, is part of a series she based on the iconic Mesoamerican blouse. Huipils are still worn in village women throughout Mexico and South America. The cloth is typically hand-woven and embroidered at the neck and down the front. The one on our wall is a collage of found fabric, scraps of cloth and lace stitched here and there with bright pink and turquoise threads, and at the neck, a golden fringe that might once have held back a theater curtain. Our other great extravagance, I say. Oh no, Beth protests, not an extravagance. I believe this is essential. Art, as those of you who know Beth, is absolutely central to Beth's life. We often remark to each other how the interests of our earliest childhood have persisted right through to the present. Beth's earliest photo, which graces the cover of her book, My Journey to 100, and which you can buy in the bookstore, is of her at the age of 2, pouring tea in the backyard for invisible friends. My earliest photo, and you can see both of them on my website, marilynsimons.com, is of me hoisting a watering can, almost as big as I am, watering my grandmother's garden. Beth still pours tea for more friends than anyone I have ever known, and I am still happiest in my garden. We have both been writing since we were children. Beth trained as an occupational therapist, then shifted to art therapy. On her wall is the first painting she ever owned, a pastoral scene her father secretly bought for her after she declared how much she loved it and then gave to her as a wedding present. Creativity of every sort, but especially art, has always been central to her life. I'm going to read a little piece called Collage. These stickies don't have a lot of sticky to them, and I'm terrified of losing them. Collage. Paintings cover every wall of Beth's house, eye level to ceiling. A huge wave rising, boulders on a shore with clouds like drifts of stone above them, small gilt-framed villages, a large abstract that could be an oriental robe. I've been in Beth's house before, but the COVID gap makes the place seem new, even though nothing has changed, except the dining room table, which is awash in objects. Awash gives the wrong impression. In the center is a heap of stocking-like shapes with cords dangling from the tops, the thready undoings of some former mobile. Small white stones take up a vaguely rectangular space, On one side, shells that range in size from tiny scallops and periwinkles to the spiraling former homes of hermit crabs and whelks. On the other side, black stones that look like puddles of polished marble. A handful of twigs, a neat stack of Japanese papers, a few skeins of bright embroidery thread. Thin blocks of wood, some the size of a matchbox, others as big as a deck of playing cards, are stacked, roughly cut from what looks like unfinished ziplap siding. A scattering of pressed dull red maple leaves. The materials aren't rare or expensive, just bits and bobs she's been gathering on her walks for years and the gleanings that friends have brought to her. I like how they feel, she says, her fingers caressing a length of chartreuse thread. Centered in front of her chair is a finished painting of torn rice paper in soft blues, searching reds. The art comes from here, she says, punching herself lightly in the chest. I don't think or plan. I just move bits of thread and paper and stones around until it feels right. Beth leads me into the living room and sits in her wooden armchair. Beside her on a small table, dark twigs are silhouetted on a rectangle of bright white paper, a forest in moonlit snow. Nothing is glued in place. The pieces aren't meant to be permanent. I think of the alfombras de acerén, the sawdust rugs that Mexican families press over the cobblestones, working through the night before Christ arrives for Easter, creating brilliant images of the Holy Family, flowers and crucifixes, all of it obliterated within hours by the feet of singing pilgrims moving down the street behind life-size wooden statues of Jesus, Mary, and St. John the Apostle. When a piece is pleasing, Beth moves the construction, she calls them her collages, from the dining room to this little table by her armchair, where it stays until a new idea, another urge, moves her. Then she sets the collage on the floor, photographs it, and dismantles it, returning the materials to her dining room table to become something new. It is important that the materials are there, on the table, where I can pass and pause and create spontaneously, she says. I just go to the table and whoosh, I'm off on a journey. Out of yourself, I ask, or deeper in? Oh, deeper, deeper. I go there and the world moves away. Beth doesn't cast about for theories as to why she does what she does at her dining room table. Beauty sustains me, she says. A friend of mine, a woman I've known since first year university, recently admitted that since she turned 75, she's noticed a change in her internal dialogues. She finds herself saying things like, "Don't do that, for heaven's sakes, you're 75. Or, "What can you expect? You're 75. We hear that from our doctors, from our kids, from television. You're old. What do you expect? In this culture, ageism is endemic. We talk about older people the way we used to talk about women, about people of color, as somehow lesser simply for being who they are. We may not be able to change how we are seen in the world, but we can at least change how we talk about ourselves." This next section, if I haven't lost it, I'll do it. Oh, here we are. The next section is called Following the Floating Byways. Beth chooses her words carefully. I have learned to pay attention, which is harder now that I am in Mexico and we have to speak along phone lines that crackle and pop. Today she says, "I have a sense with my vintage that there are things I want to do before I leave." Leave, not pass, not die. Vintage, not advanced age. Vintage is different from old. It suggests not only the past, but the best part of the past. The term comes from the 15th century word vendange, meaning wine harvest. A vintage wine being one made primarily from grapes harvested during a single year, a very good year. Not only old, but of exceptional quality. What things do you want to do? I ask. I often ask Beth questions. Sometimes she answers. In general, she doesn't like to talk about herself. She's probably squirming right now that I'm reading all about her. She'd rather write those private thoughts on paper. Still, I have slowly come to know more about her, how she thinks, what she has lived, the things she has accepted, the ways she has adapted, celebrating what remains. I know she loves to dance and still wants to, although that is mostly behind her now. And I know she loves projects, which she dives into with enthusiasm. Projects are her panacea. I can't read anymore. For some reason, I am seeing double. Actually, I was seeing, what was the word for eight times? I don't even know what that word is. But I've been listening to Lisa Xiao Chen's novel, Activities of Daily Living, which spins around the notion of projects. Why we humans take them on, how projects define time, leave a mark on the present that survives into the future when the present becomes the past. Projects create the increments by which we mark a life. Look, we say, this is what I did last winter, last year, 10 years ago. Beth and I have been walking and talking for a year, our notebooks already bulging with what we have both come to refer to as the book project. Project comes from the Latin... I used to know how to pronounce this. I actually narrated the audiobook for this book, and so I had a phonetic pronunciation in front of me, so now I have to try to remember what that is. Okay. Project comes from the Latin progessere, to throw forward. The Webster Dictionary calls a project an idle scheme, an impractical design. Right. But I find that dismissive. Embedded in the word is the notion of a start, a throw, and an intention, forward. Although it doesn't imply an end. This makes a project less a search than an opening up, allowing oneself to feel that stir of curiosity, of delight, that swelling of faith when you sense something can come of a project, this thing that Chen calls following the floating byways of life. What is it you want to do before you leave? I repeat, mentally making a list of possibilities. But Beth reaches beyond her to-do list. I'm thinking of making something with stamps, she says. Really? Stamps? What on earth can come of stamps? Well, I'll tell you. You'd be surprised. I collected stamps as a child, and so did my husband Wayne and his mother. And I expect a lot of you did too. That was back when people wrote letters. What are children collecting now? I don't know. That transports them out into the wider world the way stamps did for us. In any case, when Beth told me she was doing something with stamps, I dug out my stamp album and eventually Wayne's and his mother's shoeboxes full of stamps and gave them all to Beth. She trimmed the envelope backing off the stamp and arranged the stamps in heaps on her dining room table according to color. She procured pieces of thin plywood that became her canvases for her remarkable stamp paintings. If you want to see her first triptych, which she created during the first COVID winter, take a drive up to Delta, Ontario. It's about an hour north of here on, what, Highway 15? More or less, no?
15 to 45.
15 and 42, right. Thank you. it's on Highway 42. Take a drive up to Delta and visit the post office, because Beth's triptych is hanging on the wall of the post office, and honestly, it is a miracle. We all need a passion that is our own, Beth said to me. How can we navigate a journey that pushes and pulls at us as hard as life does, unless we can imagine? And Beth is right. Life does push and pull at us from the moment we are born. No stage is easy. I'm going to now read a section called The Happiness of Getting Old. Today I bring Tomás Martínez's The Tango Singer to my visit with Beth. In the novel, a student travels to Buenos Aires to search amid the political protests and riots for a tango singer. He describes a party where a woman, not the tango singer, arrives looking radiant, although as the night wears on, bags slouch under her eyes. If I pointed this out, the author says, she'd touch them with the tips of her fingers and say, without sarcasm, it's the happiness of getting old. I read the passage to Beth. Her skin is still impossibly smooth, especially compared with mine. Now that my moon face has subsided, it's as saggy and wrinkled as a deflated balloon. Of course, we are all growing older from the minute we slip out of the womb. But there is a point at which we deem a person to have moved beyond older into old. No matter how well we dress or how sharp our mind, the body betrays its age. Earlobes lengthen, gums recede, teeth yellow, the signature becomes shaky, the voice hushed. Beth and I talk about mumps and measles and chickenpox, all the usual childhood diseases. In the 20s, when she was a child, there was also diphtheria, whooping cough, tuberculosis, and polio. Most of these now reduced to a historical footnote, although perhaps not to continue that way. Last night, brushing her teeth before bed, Beth thought suddenly of quinsy, an old-fashioned disease like miasma and consumption, and that other bygone catch-all, a failure to thrive. Maybe it doesn't help to attempt to understand suffering in advance. Maybe I can't smooth the way for my children, because they know that their aging will be theirs and not mine. If my grandmother had had a pacemaker, her heart might not have stopped in her sleep. If my mother had been treated with today's Alzheimer's medications, she might have been with us a decade longer. There are vaccines now for certain kinds of cancer. Who knows what fixes will be available to my children and theirs? Still, the belief persists in me that humans, we females at least, share common physical experiences. We get our period and lose our period, our skin, hair, eyes, joints drying up as if we've stumbled into a desert. We submit to yearly mammograms and gynecological exams in hopes of spotting breast and cervical cancers before it's too late. It's just aging, the doctors say, turning away from ailments that might be addressed. It's just aging, friends say. Even so, just because these are expected, is the constellation of changes that come with age and illness any less distressing and difficult to bear? Dwindling energy is one of the most boring things about being old. That's from Diana Athill. She wrote that in Somewhere Towards the End. You have to resign yourself to doing less, or rather, taking more breaks than you used to. Beth agrees with the bit about taking breaks, but we both object to the phrase, resign yourself. Is there ever a stage when we don't have to adapt to what life throws at us? For 2 years, I haven't been able to leave the house by myself for fear of falling or collapsing from fatigue. Okay, fine, then who can I find to walk out with me? It's not much different from being 9 months pregnant and making sure you're never far from a bathroom, or having a gaggle of children that never allow you a moment's rest. Our bodies make demands. We meet them. What else is there to say? Basically, I think we all know this from our own lives or from that of our children and friends, is that life can be hard at any age. We fall ill, our lives fall apart one way or another, people we love leave us. This, I think, though, is the hallmark of the new age I have entered and that Beth has been living through for 30 years. One after another, the people we love are leaving. There are deaths all through life, car accidents that take school friends, aggressive cancers and heart attacks out of the blue that take friends in midlife. But now, hardly a month goes by without another face erased from the sprawling class picture of my life. This space that Beth and I are moving through may be colorful and still full of opportunity, but it is fragile, ready at any moment to be blown away by the winds of fortune or to collapse at our feet. There are many ways into this house of cards, but only one exit, and the crowd is thinning. I'm going to read a little piece called Demons and how to deal with them. Beth's anxiety is on the rise again, but she's not one to leave such feelings to fester. This is the kind of thing that I love about our friendship, as I learn how to deal with these things. She tells me about one of her closest friends, a man who believes in rituals. Every day, he sets aside a certain time to confront his demons. I decided I had to do that too, Beth said. I sat down with my yellow pad of paper and pen and wrote about what the pandemic is doing to me, what it is like going through these COVID times. I went deeper and deeper. Then I wrote a poem about my daughter, and I realized that is where the anxiety is coming from. I leaned forward into the heart of her story. Beth says, "I am afraid to die without my daughter. I always thought she'd be with me at the end." I think immediately of something I read in Joan Didion's memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, that there is simple mourning, filled with sadness, regret, perhaps loneliness, but which doesn't disrupt daily life. Then there is the complicated, visceral grief that hits in waves, choking you, plunging you down until you gasp for breath. A grief that can last for years, that comes with the death of someone whose life is intricately interwoven with your own. Beth called her friend of the rituals, whose background embraces both art history and psychiatry. "I am in trouble," she said to him, "and I know you can help me." "Hang a lantern out in the garden," he suggested, "and light it at the same time every evening." Beth takes me out to her back porch, where she has fastened an iron lantern to the corner of the railing. Inside the lantern is a blue-green candle that she has been lighting every evening at dusk. For all of us, there are times when a ritual that has a connection with your soul, your mind, and your spirit can have a steadying influence. She puts her hand on the lantern. "This is mine." I admit I fantasize about funerals. True confession. The church, the flowers, the eulogy, the grief. I've buried my parents, my husband's parents, a child I was desperately close to when I was 16. I know how grief works, how it clenches the heart and empties the bowels and blackens the mind and even makes the skin hurt. But the funerals I fantasize are never mine. I'm alive and well and sitting in a pew. But I do fantasize also about deathbeds, and the deathbed is my own. What will get me in the end? The long drawn out dying of cancer, the sudden smack of a bus, a spasm of the heart, and I should tell you that at the beginning, and this year, when we put together the festival, I insist that we put together something that we call the Hit by the Bus book. And this is a book, a very, very thick book, that contains everything that each of the coordinators knows that has to take place at the festival. All the hosting scripts, the moderator scripts, the volunteer schedules, the list of contacts, the list of the volunteers and their contact, everything. Because any one of us could be hit by a bus at any time. So, and I'm not really obsessed with this. I don't think about my own death much, but dying is a different matter. I would like to die well. And I think about the afterlife, not my own, the afterlife for those I leave behind. Will I go first, or will I, like my sister, be the one who wakes in the night to hear my husband's last breath? Will Wayne stumble out of bed like our friend the rock star, whom you all know as Owen, and fall dead in an instant, a blockage in his lungs? Will it be cancer of the stomach, like my husband's mother, of the pancreas, like my father, a massive brain bleed, the slow waning of congestive heart failure, or a sudden heart attack, like my mother, rescued at last from dementia? I am a writer, and I am used to determining the plot. What confounds me about dying is that I will have no say in the end of this. I want to close. I hope this is, good timing. I do time it, but only once. I usually time it again and again and again. I want to close with a piece called Anamkara. Anamkara is a Gaelic phrase that Beth introduced me to and that I have come to love very much. Where is it? I feel like I skipped something important. It's not. Okay. This is the first time I've read from the book. Okay, yes, here it is. Anamkara. Oh, and I know there's an Irishman in here, so he'll probably be able to tell me if I pronounce that incorrectly. Beth and I do not eat potato chips and drink martinis while discussing the merits of one method of suicide over another, as Anne Sexton did with Sylvia Plath. We do not write each other long, impassioned letters like Anne Patchett and Lucy Greeley. Neither is our friendship like that between Virginia Woolf and Catherine Mansfield, a broil of rivalries and jealousies plastered over with notes claiming undying inspiration and love. Aristotle called friendship the art of holding up a mirror to each other's souls. That comes close to what I feel Beth and I are to each other. Emerson didn't try to come up with a definition of this abiding relationship, but he did extol its twin pillars of truth and tenderness, words that ring true to me. All these attempts at defining the undefinable have a rightness to them, but when I think of my friendship with Beth, my mind settles on the Irish poet and philosopher John O'Donohue, who titled his masterwork Anamkara, Gaelic for soul friend. Originally, teachers and priests in the old Celtic religion were addressed as Anamkara, people to whom you opened your mind and your heart. This friendship, writes O'Donohue, was an act of recognition and belonging. When you had an Anamkara, your friendship cut across all convention, morality, and category. You were joined in an ancient and eternal way with the friend of your soul. This art of belonging awakened and fostered a deep and special companionship. My friendship with Beth cuts across age, across circumstance, across everything. Beth and I have that kind of relationship. We approach each other with integrity and honesty. When she doesn't like a piece in this book, she tells me, and we work it out, adding and subtracting until it sits right with both of us, or we get rid of it. I don't think there's anything we haven't talked about except perhaps money and sex. When we come up against boundaries, we respect them. Friends, we agree, are like threads weaving through the tapestry of our lives. Some show up early and leave after a short time. Others weave in and out over decades. Still others emerge only near the end. Each friend is unique, but they all share one quality. They are people who, as Jorge Luis Borges put it, make us happy for the simple chance encounter of having crossed our path. I feel understood in Beth's presence in a full and precious way. I hope she feels the same. We share truths with each other. We revel in our shared delights. We laugh a lot. Inevitably, I walk away from our visits feeling refreshed, as if her friendship is an elixir I have sipped, an elixir that has changed me in the best possible way. Inside this friendship, we are not 73 or 103 or 75 and 105 as we are now. We are ageless. The passionate heart never ages, writes O'Donohue. And that feels true too. Beth and I are not the same. Each of us moves through life in our own way. Beth makes her collages with colored thread and stamps and stones. She gathers circles of friends around her teapot. She looks for happiness and finds it. I tend my gardens, tilt my face to the birds, search for meaning in words. I look for happiness and I find it. I'm so glad, Beth says to me on our last phone call before another year ends. I'm so very glad we are on this journey together.
One last reflection. This is a wrap on the 17th edition of Kingston Writers Fest. I'll ask Marilyn if she wanted to have the last word today. And at 5:50 this morning, she sent me a few. Wash and clean everything. Do not pack dirty dishes, coffee makers. Do not pack any food. Tape a big page to the top of every bin. Clean out all the fridges. Holly is taking the food and drink. We'll have a party in October. And last point, my heart is full. This has surpassed our wildest hopes and dreams.
Just heard from the September 21st, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Walking with Beth. Marilyn Simons reading from and talking about her latest book, titled same, Walking with Beth. It is less than a minute. It's, well, let's just call it 59 minutes after 4 o'clock, so we're almost to the second hour. I'd like to thank you for tuning into the first hour today. I'd also like to thank Marilyn for a wonderful event, and also the Kingston Writers staff for both that event and just a wonderful job of the whole series of events this year. I hope you can stay tuned to the second hour of the show today to hear Theodore Christou's and my book launch event that was recorded in January, on January 27th. And I